Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is Vaishnavi Sundar, who is a filmmaker and writer in India. In this conversation, we talk about her recent documentary called Dysphoric, which is in four parts and available on YouTube. It explores transgender ideology and its effect upon women's sex-based rights. We talk about her documentary. We also talk about the experience of women in India, which is pretty intense. This is a very eye-opening conversation for me. I learned a whole lot about a completely different culture from mine and get to know Vaishnavi as a very happy nihilist. I don't know if she would allow me to consider her that, but that's how she came off to me. So without further ado, here is Vaishnavi Sundar.
I'm a writer. I'm a self-taught filmmaker, and I've been a grassroots activist for the past, a decade. I've been associated with a lot of organizations working on specific things that concern women's sex-based rights. Up until very recently, I was also totally enthralled by the liberal feminism. So I was also, you know, going after sex work is work, trans women are women, and you know, everything that concerns liberal feminism. I was also basically parodying that. But slowly it started, yeah.
Was that, do you think that that was because you grew up in a very patriarchal environment and liberal feminism was kind of like blowing the lid off of that in a way?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you come from absolutely nothing, even a little bit seems like a lot.
Yeah.
But then when I moved over and I found radical feminism, that seemed like a total weight off of the chest. It's just like, whoa, that makes so much more sense. Because when you're a liberal feminist, you're under so much pressure because you're like constantly thinking, so is this okay? Should I say it's okay? Because will it offend somebody or, you know, things like that.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if you were ever at one point also being this choice feminist ally or whatever, but I was constantly very worried about my position in the society in India and whether or not I'm allowed to comment about something, because invariably there is a section of the society that's getting pissed off.
Yeah.
Okay. But now I don't care. I'm just speaking the truth, my truth, and it concerns women. Doesn't matter where they belong. It's for my activism, my advocacy is for adult human females. And this is a lot easier, a lot simpler, actually. Mm. I mean, a lot depressing and lonely, but it is what it is.
Huh. Yeah, liberal feminism has a polite society kind of like this subversive or submerged pecking order, it seems. Like there's a lot of policing, of language, of this is that, this other thing is that, and you don't cross these lines. Is that kind of your experience?
Yeah, I mean, they constantly contradict themselves. So, you know, coming from India, you have like this rigid social structure of caste. And if you're from a certain caste, you obviously have all the privileges. Therefore, you need to be careful about what you're commenting on, you know, whether you have the rightful position to comment about something that doesn't concern you, where you have the privilege, but somebody else doesn't. Now, that's something that's, you know, common, you know, for a male to shut up when a woman is speaking, things like that. So it's like a common sense. So that was fine. But they would contradict themselves by going against women belonging to the marginalized community by upholding the interests of men from the lower community too. So you gotta pick your sides here, right?
Okay. Yeah. So with regards to this group you're talking about, they're playing the kind of the savior game of labeling who's oppressed and who's not oppressed, and then trying to figure out how to equalize the playing field or be on the right side of history in a way? No.
No, they're not doing any of that. They're just trying to, one, they're playing victims themselves a lot and trying to, with their victimhood, trying to earn some sort of a special status. And the other side is that they're not working towards equalizing or leveling the playing field. What they're doing is they're just policing people as to what they should or shouldn't do or should or shouldn't feel. That seemed rather restrictive. I mean, if it is about choice, what about my choice about speaking up about something that I disagree with? Yeah. Everything must be okay then. So this whole freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and this whole thing about porn being empowering and prostitution being liberating, those were all my, you know, those were needling me. Those didn't seem right. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's when gradually I sort of digressed from liberal feminism, at least these aspects of liberal feminism. There's like a very solid anti-caste movement in India, but they're all majoritatively liberal feminists. So you see them, they will be speaking against the caste system, but they will also say trans women are women.
Okay.
Because they are looking at it from the vantage point of caste, and they believe that the people that are feeling differently, and in this case, they are referring to the eunuchs, the hijras, who are not trans.
Oh.
Most of them come from not a very well-to-do family. They probably are not educated. These are effeminate men. They look a certain way, so the society kind of ostracizes them, and they have nowhere to go. They're probably homosexuals. So that group of people, the hijras, have been totally appropriated by the liberal feminist movement. And because most of these hijras are seen seeking alms, begging on street, they look at it from the vantage point of the caste angle and the poverty angle. So they believe that you have to annihilate them from this shackle of caste and poverty. Therefore, they support them, not understanding that by supporting them, they're taking away the rights of some other community. Does that make sense?
I know that the hijras, if I'm pronouncing that right, they are used in discourse in America as this third sex. They're used to,
third
gender. And there's other things, but it seems like a lot of nuance is lost about what exactly this community is. It seems like it's a subset of what we would call, well, before this genderology came to being, we would just call like very effeminate homosexuals. And they usually probably migrate to big cities where they can find each other and not be so persecuted, in the more conservative areas. They're not like something new. They're just something more or less rare. And they don't topple the binary structure. They just are what they are in a way.
Yep, absolutely. A lot of them don't even care about being male, female, or anything. They just want to be hijras. They just want their life and whatever they're doing. They want to just not be disturbed, really. But there's a very, very dark story or very dark history to this whole culture of eunuchs, the whole culture of hijras that not a lot of people, be it in the West or even in India, Indian social media basically parrots everything that the US says without even probably picking up a single book their whole life. But the truth is they have a very dark, deviant history because they're ostracized and they're persecuted for presenting the way they do. Mm-hmm. They're often sometimes even sold for, or rather trafficked for the titillation or for sexual favors of older homosexual men who otherwise probably have like a family and a regular heterosexual life. But they have this other life where they go to these brothels and there are these children. There's apparently true stories of where young boys who look a certain way are sort of bid on, you know, like you sort of set auctioned. Like a certain amount of money. Yes, you auction them.
Wow.
And whoever gets the highest bid takes them to the brothel, and this kid would probably just stay there for the rest of his life.
Okay.
And, you know, there is like this initiation, like an induction ceremony where they actually castrate. And this is not done in a clinical safe way. There's this belief that there is this goddess who is blessing them by giving them this other life, the second chance to life, where they can now truly be a woman. So some other eunuch who is a senior would do the castration procedure, is no doctor, doesn't have any clue about what he is doing. And most of the time, this man who is being castrated is left to bleed because it is their belief, a superstition, that what's bleeding out is the maleness. And when it stops bleeding, some of them die. But when it stops bleeding for like 7-8 days, it's usually the time that women are set aside for menstrual cycle. They sort of leave the men to bleed. And apparently, as soon as the bleeding is done and they're fine, they have truly become women. So, and there's so much to talk just about the hijras, actually. And it's really... it's annoying how the West or even people in India are like, oh, hijras have existed from a really long time. Yes, they have. But they've got nothing to do with this really ridiculous queer theory that we are facing right now. That's most of them want to just be left alone. Then and they have this very oppressive social structure, by the way. You've got like a teacher and you've got a student. So a teacher has to opt for you. She has to take you in. And if she takes you in, you've got to earn money and pay her every day.
Okay.
And how do you earn that money? By begging and prostituting yourself.
Yeah. And they use female pronouns then? The history?
Well, yeah, they dress like female, and they all probably have like their hijra name, which the teacher would give.
Oh, wow. Oh,
it's like,
wow.
Yeah. It's like a new world, a new life for them.
Yeah, okay. And do you know how far back this community goes?
There are books written about there being hijras, eunuchs, that are guarding the sanctum sanctimonium of Muhammad because it's considered to be so pious and so pure that women aren't allowed inside. And and because women aren't allowed inside, you can't have women guarding that place. And at the same time, you can't have men guarding that place because it would be a threat or it would be not okay because they can be as powerful as somebody else. So it's there in the Muhammadan history, and it's also there in the Mughal history, where these eunuchs would be castrated and be kept so close to the king. They're so powerful in the sense that some of the big decisions in the kingdom can be made by the eunuchs of the court. And they're emasculated because they can't be men, otherwise they can defeat the king, because considering how close they are. And they can't be women because then they will be desirable and that will lead to other promiscuous issues. So
yeah.
They're emasculated, castrated, and are serving the court generation after generation.
Yeah. Is there a similar group, and not exactly at all, but something vaguely similar for women? Is there a women caste, like that's historical, a priestesshood or a smaller community of that sort?
Well, the goddess, the concept of goddess has always existed in India, right?
Mm-hmm.
This word called Shakti, which means power, is attributed to the female energy, the feminine energy, or something like that. So for every god, there is a goddess. And, you know, when things get really bad for women in the world, it is believed that the female goddess would, the goddess would sort of really just, you know, take over and behead all the horrible people in the world because she's just so pissed off with the way women are being treated. So there's like this Kali, Shakti, and all these, these goddesses that are seemingly very powerful, and you don't want to piss them off or something like that. And often the trouble with these goddesses is they are considered to be so chaste and so perfect that sometimes real women like me are expected to uphold that kind of a chastity and that kind of a, what shall we say, morals. So okay, you're either that goddess or you're a prostitute.
Yeah. Is there a similar pressure put upon males to be upright?
Of course, to constantly be never vulnerable and to constantly treat women like second grade things and, you know, the usual, to be assholes. They have so much pressure to be assholes all the time that to be normal would seem like an insult, because that would mean that you are, all the horrible slurs in Indian language is a synonym to female or woman. So, you know, like in the US, why are you being such a pussy?
Yeah.
There are so many such variants of men who don't uphold that toxic masculinity, and they will constantly be called that. Okay. And this goes from the way you look, if you don't look macho enough, or if you're not, for example, engaging in violence against women, you would be deemed a woman. Hmm. Because that's like the absolute swear word you can use to a man, because that might basically destroy him.
Emasculate him.
Yeah.
Is this behavior cross class? Is there different expectations for the different castes behave in a different way with regards to intersex relationships?
I guess with each caste and class comes a certain outlook to life, right? If you're of a certain class, slightly more privileged, you have the access to education, perhaps you would be an educated asshole. You probably get drunk and say horrible shit in the middle of the road. You won't probably beat your wife or children in the middle of the road, but you'd probably do it in an air-conditioned house. But the male violence is like an epidemic in this country. It doesn't matter if you are an educated, upper caste man. There are cases where there are inter-class violence also. It's not necessarily the women that you're married to or the women that you gave birth to you. It's like this inter-caste, inter-class violence that men perpetrate as well. So they basically are like fluid, okay, they can basically navigate this social structure and be assholes to basically anybody.
Okay. Is there a very, from your point of view, is there very, like a highly pressured hierarchy that men are subjugated to other men as well? And then they're exhausting all of that subjugation onto women. Do you think that that's kind of how it works? Or how is it built into the society that women are treated this way, from your perspective?
Well, it's everything. You look around you. You know your place in the society. I knew that I was not equal to my sibling when I was really young, when I shouldn't be understanding all these things. You know, like I said elsewhere, you probably don't have the words for it, the language for it, but you know something's not right. And you learn it at such a young age that there isn't any time to be a child, a female child, even worse.
Okay.
So there isn't a sort of a pressure per se, because there are men that are, you know, slightly tolerable, decent human beings as well that I know of, who are my friends and who I like, hashtag not all men. But it's possible, but it's just that you look around you, You see how your father behaves with your mother. You see how your brother behaves with his wife. And you see how your friends treat their wives or their sister or their mother. It's around you. So if, and there's this glorification of a man who, you know, cooks this one off day and then he's celebrated as the most amazing guy. And the rest of the day, the rest of the year, he's just like a total oppressor. You know, so it doesn't matter. So what I'm saying is there isn't a formula. If a man wants to, he can choose to not oppress. It's not a learned behavior. I mean, it is a learned behavior, so you can unlearn it. It's not an innate behavior is what I was trying to say. So you look around you, you see people behaving this way. It doesn't mean that it gets indoctrinated in your head that you're also supposed to hit your wife. You can stop that. You can break that cycle and you can sort of set a better example for the next generation, perhaps. But that's not happening. And even if your family is slightly progressive and if, you know, there isn't like this domestic violence situation like it was in my house, you learn it from someplace else. You learn it from TV. You learn it from movies. Indian movies can single-handedly change, like they do like a paradigm shift in the minds of men. There have been cases where art has imitated life, life has imitated art, and men have resorted to some acute violence against women because in the movies, ultimately the hero gets the heroine. Mm-hmm. And in real life, when this hero doesn't get the heroine, he resorts to things like stalking, pouring acid, killing, lynching, and things like that, because he has been told that if you can't score this girl, then you're not a hero, and everybody wants to be a hero.
Yeah.
So if he can't have it, nobody can have it.
What is the effect that American feminism is having with women? Is it opening up dialogue? So we kind of talked about liberal feminism, radical feminism, but just generally the American influence, because we have different mores. We are held to a different standard with regards to beating women. I mean, I know that I don't do it and I frown down upon it. But feminism in general, it's a set of tenets and there's a lot of adherence to that. How is that influencing, from your point of view, India, bringing light to this issue, maybe moving the needle in a different direction towards sex equality, if not just basic human respect?
I think, unfortunately, the needle is moving in the direction that is not favoring women's sex-based rights, because what liberal feminists are doing in the U.S. is what is being parroted over here. Be it in the form of change of curriculum in schools or these extracurricular gender sensitivity trainings, which non-governmental organizations go to school and try to shove down your throat. All those things are a direct response to what the U.S. is doing or what the U.S. believes is progressive or woke or what they think is a valuable education that you need to give to the next generation. I would like to think that they're doing it in good faith. You know, that they don't realize the ramifications, that they are really thinking that by doing this, they are helping these children to be better citizens in the future. But they can't keep riding that tide for a very long time, because there are other, even though they are very feeble voices, there are opposing voices like mine, for example. Mm-hmm. I am constantly saying that gender is the single most smartest, most strategic thing that has has come down, that will singularly wipe out, erase women.
Okay.
I believe that. I believe that if we keep feeding this whole gender bullshit, the first and the most affected would be women in the most marginalized communities, and then work its way upwards.
Okay.
So
I think that that's a very important point that we should open up, because I think that, you know, the liberal feminism the liberal feminists in America, probably, you know, in the West, they are doing their work on top of already these gains. They've made solid gains, material gains with regards to property, voting rights, etc. Things aren't perfect, but they have these solid gains. of very solid equality under the law and protections within the law. And then there's that, the upper crust Clinton feminism that can start playing around with this gender stuff because they're already insulated by all their money and their wealth and all those things. So when that gender stuff is imported to place without those solid rights, it already works to erode any gains that women could be making with regards to just getting basic equality, basic security, and so on. Am I hearing you right? Is that a good way of putting it?
Yes, but just as an addition to that, Indian law is one of the most comprehensive law there is in the whole world. Okay. The law is so detailed, and it is it sort of comes to be after almost a decade of activism and advocacy, because we have this system where it has to pass through the lower house and the upper house, and the president has to okay it, and then it becomes a law, and then there are amendments to it depending on the case-to-case basis. Some of the laws that exist for women is indeed, as law, so amazing that the whole world can basically take it and template it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The challenge is...
Is it implicated, though, in India?
Exactly. The challenge is the implementation. They always falter in the implementation. And the trouble is, you can't really question the government or the law about the failure of implementation, because that's not their prerogative. And when they hand you the law, they deprive you of the right to question the implementation.
Oh, okay.
In the sense, you can't say, well, you gave us the law, but it's not being implemented, and it's not their problem. It's the criminal justice system's problem. It's the court's problem. It's the police station's problem.
Okay.
While we've worked very hard to be as elaborate as possible to include all kinds of permutation combination in sort of coming together, putting together a law, the moment the law has been passed, your right to fight for that law is gone, obviously, because the law exists now. There is nothing to fight.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But by depriving us of that ability to fight later on, even after the law is passed, what they've done is they've deprived us to challenge the implementation also. So at the face of it, Indian law is great, except the fact that it's an adversarial model, which basically removes the victims away from the whole investigation process. That's my only complaint against it. But otherwise, as the written law itself, our constitution and everything is perhaps the most wholesome and the most democratic law that's ever been written. And some of the most amazing people have practically slaved themselves their entire life in coming up with all these laws that I'm able to enjoy today.
Yeah. But you say that there's a breakdown between the law and then how it's actually implemented, which seems like kind of a major flaw in what's going on over there.
Yeah, but it's a huge country. It's a huge country, and we have different states, and there's a state law, and there's a central law, and there's all kinds of bureaucracy, red tape, some bribe, poverty, illiteracy, you name it, we've got all of it.
Yeah.
So, if we get like a success rate of, say, 5% implementation success rate, right, and that means that you can basically celebrate, you can quit activism, and you can rejoice for the rest of your life.
We did it! Oh, no.
Yeah, we did it. We've got 5% implementation rate. Oh, my God, it's so amazing.
Huh. Yeah. So taking that, and this is fascinating, you're totally educating me, and I know a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this as well, because it's just a great adventure into another culture. Taking that, what you were just describing about law and government and implementation, the idea of gender supersedes the idea of sex. And what is the implication of that? That's the problem of trying to convince people that there is this magic trick that's going on with critical race theory in America, but I think which is different. Critical race theory is very American. I don't know how that would sweep around the globe, but the gender ideology stuff, because it's attacking, or because it's a part of something that everybody shares, being mother, father, man, woman, all that relationship, it can be exported across the globe, and you see it being exported across the globe. So from your point of view, how does the gender ideology mess around and devalue sex-based rights? What does it do? How does it function? What do you see it going to do in your country?
Well, it starts with the language. We speak about, I don't even know, we speak like a lot of languages, more than 100 languages, and there are different dialects to each language, some of them so unique that two people speaking the same language in different dialects can't understand each other. We're very diverse. And I live in the south, the southernmost tip of the country. I have no idea how many different dialects there are in the northeast or in the west or in the north. I have no idea. Not even, I probably don't even know the many different dialects that are in my state. That is how diverse we are. Now, with the multitude of languages comes the challenge of implementing a common law. Law is words. Is words. You know, words is what makes law. Now, when you do not have two distinct words to mean gender and sex separately, there begins the problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's like kind of a Western invention. I'm sure not every language even finds that concept useful enough to have the words.
Yes, yes. Most of the time when we do have the word, even if we do have like a probably slightly ambiguous yet two distinct words, it is often conflated as each other.
Yeah, yeah. Just like sex and gender is up until there's this tiny thing that's happening right now.
Yeah. Now, given that there are so many languages and given that the law is about words and then there is no clear distinction, and the fact that we are an extremely conservative country and only in 2018 we had homosexuality decriminalized, we're still in Stone Age, man. We certain things that you talk about online, you probably can't talk to a random person walking on the street. It's considered to be a taboo. And the word sex is always giggled away because the word sex is like the act of sex, the intercourse.
Yes, yes.
And it's often so shameful to use it in conversation. And you say, when you say sex-based rights, it's often giggled at and misunderstood as right to have sex.
So even the word sex itself, in America, it has two different definitions: one, the act, and then other, the fact of two, you know, biologically distinct sexes. Even that itself is difficult to talk about, or is stuck in one interpretation.
Yes, that's pretty much the same over here as well. And you can't talk about sex-based rights without waiting for an entire room of people to break the ice and stop giggling about the word sex, and then you can move on and talk about the real issue. I get invited in universities to talk about films, feminism, and stuff. I often visit, work with children, students, and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, I have to really break the ice right at the beginning because my entire talk is centered around sex, the biological sex. And I mean, although I am very happy to talk about the act of sex, the intercourse, that's another issue altogether. We do not have a concrete sex education for us to stop giggling about it. I know when I was in school decades ago, our biology teacher would basically just, you know, hold the chapter and just move the pages to the next chapter because she doesn't think it's important for girls and boys to know how babies are born.
Wow. Okay.
And when you ask them, so what about the exam? What if we get a question in the, and we have like this model where you can answer 3 out of 5 questions, for example, they'll be like, answer the other 4.
Okay. This is also the country that brought the world the Kama Sutra, and some of those temples are very explicit out there. So it's kind of interesting.
Pre-colonization, my friend. Pre-colonization.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that is an entire level. I'm going to propose something. Please refine my point of view. But the way that the British entered into India and controlled it was to basically equate themselves with the upper class. And so all of their mores were passed on as the educated elite. Like they formed the elite in their image. And then India has been reverberating with that. And so all of the mores, the morality, and then the hang-ups, etc., perpetuate in the educated class. Is that kind of what happens, and then, or what has happened?
Yes, yes, and that, and a lot of Christian moralities as well.
Yeah,
because colonization. And a lot of that's probably why, even though we have temples with an orgy sculpture, we only decriminalized homosexuality 2 years ago. So there's like this contrast of what the colonizers did to a country which would have perhaps been progressive so soon. Maybe you don't know, you know, you don't know what life would be like pre-colonization, pre-imperialization, or life right now if your country was not colonized. There is no way for you to understand that. There are some good things, you know, the way they sort of standardized education system and things like that. There's some plus points to it, but then I guess they did it so they can live happily in a colonized country. It's not for the well-being of the people, the colonized people. A lot, even though we've written Kama Sutra and our mythology is filled with topless women who, even now, there are some tribes in India, in the very interior parts of India, where modesty is a word that is not entirely understood, at least not attributed to the exteriors. So even though we have Kama Sutra, we can continue to remain homophobic and pretend like we can't understand that two people can fall in love irrespective of.
Could you repeat that last bit? You broke up.
Yeah. I said, even though we have Kama Sutra, today we can continue to pretend like homosexuality is horrible and that two people do not have the rights to fall in love with each other. Okay. So it's that's what's happening even now. Like my mother's generation, for example, if you hear the dogs, that's my India experience for you. they kind of like go around and
And for the listener, you're in, it's midnight where you are. So
it's about 20 minutes to midnight. That's when my all these dogs are like my dogs. They're in my street and we kind of know them. So they just come out and play around in the middle of the night because other times there are people and it's anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
So busy.
We can continue to, you know, pretend like homosexuality doesn't exist, even though we have scriptures in the past that make people believe. Oh, that's another thing, right? The scriptures is like a it plays a huge role in the way queer theory has anchored itself now. What the Westerners have also done is they've appropriated our mythology, where there has been stories written. It's a myth. It's mythology, right? There are stories where a male god became female.
Yeah, Arjuna in the Mahabharata. That's what happens.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah, that's one. Yeah, he's cursed by this woman to live a life as a woman so he can understand what it means to be a woman. Of course, they've sort of taken that and made him transgender and all of that. But in the even there's so many other stories also, not just Arjuna, right? Where one god became a woman and had an erotic relationship with this other god, and they gave birth to another god. Right, if that's even possible, because it's myth, everything is possible. So that happens, and what they've done is they've taken all our myths and all those scriptures and everything, and they've turned it into the postmodern modern day queer theory references, claiming that transgenderism dates all the way back to Hindu mythology, so it must be true and things like that. There are also incidents of there being eunuchs in other religions in India as well, even though Hindu religion is like a majority religion in India. But there are also, you know, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism, Sikhism, Parsi. There are all kinds of people. It's very diverse. And in all those people's mythology also, there are some references to this man dressed as a woman or a man seeking out other men dressed like a woman. I don't know. So there's so many such references, which has all been entirely taken and appropriated by Indians as well as the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah. India is such a powerful, the mythology and the culture and the layers and the caste system, it's so incredibly complex there's all these different forces. I don't know how you conceptualize about it. I don't even know how you be an activist in that. I guess you have to focus on like just one thing because it's such a dynamic, all these layers and layers and layers of culture. And then it's built on centuries and centuries and centuries of culture. So it's really interesting, you know, the progressive academic in America who's all about not appropriating anything is going through and taking things, bits and pieces, and completely leaving the rest of the structure, how that all works together, how it's not even holistic so much as just frothing with all these references and intuitions and all that stuff. And then, of course, the Westerner comes over and says, okay, this is my argument, and I'm going to pluck it all from your tree over there.
And Indians reinforce that. We're saying, yeah, you know, our culture is so rich and diverse, you know?
Yeah.
Here, take
it. Which I understand. I'm not a big proponent of, you know, cultural siloing. I think that cultural appropriation isn't necessarily bad. I think it's very human. It's a human thing to do. But there's a way of stripping the entire system in order just to distill it into an argument that I think is kind of violating the spirit of the culture or not doing it in a creative way. I don't know.
This is not about, I don't know, a white woman braiding her hair, man. It's a lot deviant than that. I mean, I'm also not for, I'm not like this.
I mean, you're wearing denim right now, so... That's
what,
a very
is that
California.
York?
It's Californian, man. You know, Gold Rush era. So,
well, I wouldn't know.
But the way in which gender ideology will further obscure your culture, your country's relationship to basic, just talking about sex. Talking about the sexes, and then talking about, you know, trying to figure out a very trying to upgrade the relationship and the culture to something that's more humane, more equal. Like that gender ideology, it seems like will come through and just completely obscure something that's already not well defined.
Yes, that is what is happening. And, you know, when I sit in these webinars that have radical feminists from different parts of the world talking about how transgender ideology has sort of permeated into women's sex-based rights in their country, they often talk about how there are female-only spaces in which men are trying to gain access to. And yes. I'm here sitting explaining to them that there are no female-only safe spaces in the country to begin with.
Oh.
Why would men want to find access to it when there is no safe space for women to go? There are very, very few. For example, in the Vancouver Rape Crisis Center, it's an institution that is where women go to when they have experienced sexual trauma, and they are there and they stay there. They rehabilitate themselves. They undergo a lot of therapy, and then they are put back in the society. We don't have such a system.
Okay.
When women are raped in this country, 9 out of 10 times the next morning she has to get up and go to work.
Okay.
So there is no chance of us playing, you know, oh my God, all these things happen. What do I do? For many of us, it's like an everyday occurrence. 90% of the time it will be somebody like your husband or your family member doing it to you every night. You can't escape it. And the only way you can escape it is by actually physically escaping from there and go where? And you're putting yourself at risk of being molested or raped by the entire country now. Because the country is filled with these men who hold the exact same misogynistic patriarchal ideals about women. So many women just grit their teeth and live their life like that. And this is also a country where, you know, we don't have it comes in the last part of the film where we don't have access to emergency contraception. By law, you're supposed to get it over the counter. But the different states have different rules, even though it's a central law, it's a federal law. States sometimes choose to be, choose to play God and quote cultural or moral or chaste reasons why they won't sell emergency contraception to women because she dared to go and have unprotected sex. Condoms are available. Viagras are available. Pornography is available. Emergency contraception is banned. Okay. What if a woman is raped? They don't care. So this is the landscape. And I don't know, it's gender basically affects every bit of it. You remember, I briefly was talking to you about how the transgender, the eunuchs make money. They make money by prostituting themselves, and they are a huge proponent in the whole sex industry right now.
Okay.
What they're doing is, by constantly claiming that that's their livelihood, they're making it impossible for girls and women that are trafficked into the trade be unable to get out of it ever.
So the eunuchs are fighting for their economic rights and therefore keeping women stuck in that industry.
Yes, I'll give you an example. There is an anti-trafficking law. Okay, it came to existence after years and decades of fight by activists, you know, academicians, women, all of them. There is now a law, but it's toothless. And there's this group of people who are, you know, this trans rights activists, along with a foreign non-governmental organization, are now saying that this anti-trafficking law is going to cost them their livelihood. Therefore, it must not be implemented.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
You see how self-centered it is.
Oh, wow. Huh.
And so what they have done now is they have normalized prostitution, and they have made it impossible for any legal intervention for any woman who got stuck there for no fault of hers. And she's going to live there in that 4x4 room serving 20 men every night without ever be able to get out of that place. And by the way, if you are a prostitute and if you happen to have children, your children are not supposed to earn from the money that you make due to prostitution. That's illegal.
It's illegal to feed your children from the money that you get from being a prostitute.
Yes.
So
9 out of 10 times what happens is if it's a girl child, she will end up being a prostitute herself.
Okay. Yeah.
Because she can't go to school. She can't go to university.
Yeah.
Because she can't find a better livelihood for herself. Now there are some organizations that are, you know, working closely with these brothels and taking the children away, rehabilitating them, educating them. But it's such a tiny figure. But these people, these men, in order to uphold their self-centered, most selfish rights, they're making it impossible for women to survive in this country where they are already being stifled. It's not like we're enjoying such great freedom in this country as it is. We have about 87 rapes a day with 30%, less than 30% prosecution rate. Okay. Men get away with basically anything in this country. And if things get out of hand and if like a group of people sort of go after a particular case, police can burn a body alive in order to conceal evidence.
What do you mean they can?
They have done it in the past. Okay. So there's this girl who was raped, and the country sort of got together and went after the criminal justice system, wanted the chief minister of the state to intervene, find the guy, punish him. But the guy happened to be from the upper caste, and the girl was from this marginalized caste called the Dalits. Okay? The girl was burnt. The family had no idea. The family wasn't even around. She was burnt. No explanations were given. Because she was burnt, there was no forensics that could be performed to actually prove that it was, in fact, the upper caste man that raped her. Therefore, he could be punished. No, but that can't happen because upper caste men are so pure. And the state's chief minister wouldn't allow it.
You're just making me feel so naive. Like I'm trying to grapple with even getting the upper hand on such a culture. Like, how do you even begin to affect change in that? Like, at what level? And I suppose that there's different religions that enforce different rules, on their society. So Sikhs, Christians, Muslims, and others might have you might be better as a woman in those religions in India, or does that even permeate through?
Out. No, you're not. Your religion doesn't
protect you.
Safeguard you, safeguard you from the misogyny of the country. Never has. In fact, it has made it worse. Religion is anti-women. And I would argue that to my grave, you know, religion is anti-women, and anybody who has sort of managed to live a life without such grave injustice done to them, it's probably an anomaly, and their religion had nothing to do with it. Hmm. They just got lucky, perhaps. This has got nothing to do with, because she's from XYZ religion, she somehow was able to escape misogyny in this country. That has never happened. You know, the scriptures are essentially anti-women. The scriptures are written in a way that women are subjugated. How can we even argue that religion is somehow beneficial, or any particular form of community? No form of community has ever been pro-women. It has always been the case where women are considered to be the ones that are cleaning up after men, or the ones that are there for the benefit of men or for their titillation. You point me towards one community that positions women at the center of the way they live their lives. There isn't one.
Liberal feminism.
Yeah, no, but what they think women are actually men.
So. Damn. You had one chance, liberal feminism. You had one job.
No.
How do you, okay, let me go to this tech. How do you yourself keep the upper hand on this? In what way how do you connect with the joy to keep you sustained in this fight? Like what's the kernel of optimism, or, you know, did you go through the other side of nihilism? Like how do you stay, you know, together while confronting this?
I think my pessimism is what is making me fight, not the optimism. I have no hope. I am a lifelong existentialist. I am a lifelong believer of human life to be so overrated and must be nuked.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit extreme, I know. I mean, it just came up.
At least that's where we are. Okay, thank you.
But
yeah, after that. Okay.
Yeah, but you have these small wins, very very small wins, and you sort of that you make that your ground that you stand on, and then you keep building, keep building, keep building. For me, those little wins could even be things like somebody saw my film Dysphoric and said, thanks, that helped me. It's good enough, you know? So it's like a direct response or a direct reward for the work that you've done. Of course, you don't do it for the reward. But I guess it is that reward in this form, not in the form of, you know, appreciation or money or anything like that. I'm not after that. Mm-hmm. It's this reward of the social change that we're talking about, that some minute difference in the way people think. It could be about this film, or it could be about the films that I've made in the past. All of them have centered women. The previous one was about sexual harassment that women face at the workplace. A lot of companies, after having seen my film, have set up committees to look into situations like that.
Okay.
I want to work in that direction, not to go to film festivals or not to win awards or things like that. I know my kind of films would never win an award. It's just too morbid for people to sit down and watch.
And it assaults certain prevailing attitudes within those who are giving out awards. So
yes, it's a slap on their faces. I mean, if they watch it and if they do give an award, they must be really stupid to not get that. I was in fact attacking them. Yeah.
Wow. So what got you to go in the route of filmmaking? You started as a writer and then you went towards film. Is that correct?
No, I had a corporate job. I was doing 9 to 5. I was traveling the world. I was in a tech company and I was doing marketing for them. And I guess I just quit one day. I just quit. It's like cold turkey, quit. I got sick of them and I quit. And this whole foray into filmmaking was incidental, because I've done theater for more than a decade now. I've performed on stage, written plays, directed plays. I love the stage. So having come from that, you know, artistic side, if you will, making film was just like a sort of an experiment. So the first film that I made was in 2013, 14 sometime. It was just a tiny little film. I wrote a story. I taught myself how to turn it into a screenplay. I taught myself to direct the film and then produce it and, you know, whatever. So that got me interested. And in the time, ever since I graduated university and till the time I quit my job, I've done like 11, 12, 13 jobs. Everything was boring. I tried different things. Everything was just so, so dreadfully boring. I mean, I had to really, really feel motivated to get up from bed and go to job. And money has never been a motivator for me. So you really have to give me an really exhilarating task for me to, you know, feel excited about coming to work every day. That wasn't the case. I was super easily bored. It's perhaps filmmaking, the vocation that I have taken up now, okay, that I have sustained for this long. This is the first. So it happened incidentally, but yeah. I think, stuck with it for a good while.
Is YouTube a great opportunity for you, for somebody in your position to be able to distribute your films? And I wonder if there's a possibility, without getting too businessy, I just wonder how interacting with the West, if it is cheaper for you to live out there, it might be able to be sustaining and you can actually kind of build a one-woman media empire just by distributing films on the internet. Is that something that you see possible or see coming in your way?
I don't think about distributing when I first decide on making a film. I don't think about distributing it at all. When the film is done, I guess at that point I decide whether or not I want to put it behind a paywall or I want to make it available for free for everybody to watch. Yeah. The previous film is behind a paywall still. But anybody who asks, I just let them watch it for free. It's not a big deal. So I guess for me, the channel of distribution, that's there. If not YouTube, there's Archive, there's, you know, all these other new whatever. But I'm even more keen on not necessarily access to the Western audience, but what it does on ground over here. I want people here to watch it. And that's why I also have a vlog channel. It's me, I'm V, and I'm logging all things What the Fuck. So my channel is called vlog.whatthefuck. There I interview a lot of women about different aspects of being a woman in India and South Asia. I interview people from Pakistan, Nepal. I'm interviewing somebody from Sri Lanka coming Monday. And I interview Indian women about different aspects of being a woman. I talk about the law. I talk about farmer rights. I talk about domestic violence. I talk about surrogacy. I talk about all these things. I mean, they're not like super popular and I don't have like this massive viewership or anything. But to me, I'm just like, it's there. Eventually people will watch it if they want to. And it dates back to the time that I made it. So even if people watch it after a decade, they'll think, oh, she's made it 10 years ago. So she's probably aware of this issue 10 years ago. And that's good enough. I think a lot of my friends also sort of say this to me, you'll have to find a way to make this sustainable for yourself or something like that. But I just have this very crude opinion about money. Just, it's so arrogant, right? You got to depend on it so much. And I hate that.
Yeah, money is kind of a dick in that respect.
Yeah. It's such a dick. And I hate it for that. And I have, like, I've sort of designed, my tailored my life in such a way that I am least dependent on it. I don't have a car. I don't have a house. I live a very, very modest life. I wear hand-me-downs. I'm very happy to not purchase a new thing. The only thing perhaps I would invest on is, you know, tech, maybe, at best. But that's because that's what I do for my activism. But other than that, I really have no needs. So I try every day to think of ways in which I can, you know, say fuck you to money. So that's why when I do all these things, I'm not thinking, how do I turn this into cash. Yeah. But I'm thinking, how do I turn this into an actual societal change?
Yes.
This sounds so cliche or so, you know, holier than thou. But truly, you hand me like an opportunity to change the law, and you provide me with $1 billion and a lifelong commitment to me living a very happy, safe life. I would choose not the money. Because it's boring, it's mundane, and I have a hate relationship with money. I really do.
And the only humanity money... too.
Oh yeah, well that. Yes.
You do want to nuke us, just to...
No, not just you, myself including. I'm not saying I'm going to be the only lone survivor here. It's all of us. I'm more than happy to die if it's going to be better for the earth.
No, okay, let's not go there. What do you want to get into the skulls of Westerners? What do you think something that we're missing, or that you would really like us to kind of understand? If you have that, if that's a valid thought to you, and on any given topic that you choose, but we could talk about sex, we could talk about gender, feminism, etc. What's something that we should get into our heads that you see we're lacking?
Whatever people think about India, it's often limited to Bollywood or occasional film that qualifies for Oscar, or a documentary about periods
Slumdog Millionaire,
all of that. There is more to this country. And there's so much more to this country that even women in the country don't know about. So to just take a country like India and sort of have these ideas about a country, I think it's often very, very misguided. Perhaps the one thing that I would like, feminists around the world to consider is that it's so much more nuanced than that. And, you know, in countries like Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, and us, and Sri Lanka, outside of the other usual ways in which women are mistreated, there is an angle of caste as well. And these are the only countries where caste system plays a huge role. Now, caste people around the world have some understanding. They often equate that to race. While it is similar, the segregation and the oppression is similar, it's a lot more nuanced than that, because it's not just black and white over here. It's there are 100 different types of lower caste. You know, that even people belonging to the lower caste will always have somebody who they can look down upon. You understand what I'm saying? So this is like a bottomless pit. You can go really down, and
elephants
you will still
all the way down.
Yes. So it's a lot more, and at the bottom of all of that will be a woman. So we're talking about emancipating her, not someone like me. So when they think of countries like India or Nepal or whatever, they've got to keep that woman in mind. And not what they see on social media, or not what they hear in the news, because you won't find information about that woman who's sitting inside this abyss anywhere on mainstream media. Forget mainstream media, anywhere. You won't even know that she exists. There are so many people who are not part of census in this country, so many women belonging to some tribes. So I guess India has this charm, you know, it's this mystical outlook that people have about this country. And you say, India, oh, India, I've been to India. I've been to this place. I've been to that place. Yeah, great. It is beautiful or whatever. But when we're talking about women in the country, it's not just, limited to what you see on your news sources. There's a lot more graver, more deviant things that are happening to women in countries, developing countries, that people need to really open their minds to.
Yeah. Do you think that prosperity is a way forward that will break that down? Do you see any other ideologies breaking down that caste? Seems like there's something in the genetics of the culture that makes hierarchy so ingrained in everything, from what I'm gathering as a complete amateur looking at. And have you seen any ideas that erode that? Any concepts?
No.
Or even technology, is that a way forward? People being able to communicate more?
No, it will further oppress people. It will further alienate people who are in the bottom of the pyramid because they won't understand it. They won't understand technology. I will understand technology and I will probably prosper. What about somebody who can't even read? Hmm. What about somebody who doesn't have enough livelihood to feed her children or feed herself? But she just keeps getting pregnant because the husband wouldn't bother, you know, with anything. So technology will further detriment the lives of the oppressed communities, not benefited. The ones that will benefit are the people that that already have certain privileges in the country, beginning with education.
And you don't see that trickling down, education and technology.
Well, it's trickling down in the sense that people who, you know, say in my mother's generation wouldn't have gone to school. Kids from that community are now going to school, are holding positions and everything. But we are talking about the rate of change that is so sluggish that it will probably take like 5-10 lifetimes for us to be able to say, well, okay, things have truly changed for India.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah.
Because caste system is supposedly outlawed. And we still practice it.
Yeah.
We still dedicate this one set of people belonging to this one particular caste to pick shit, to clean toilets, and nobody else from any other caste is allowed to do that. Now, if you manage to escape that clutch and manage to educate yourself, go to a college and, you know, get a degree, you go to a place to work and they look at your name, they associate your caste, and they will ask you to go clean the toilets again. Because that's what your caste is supposed to do. You're born with it and you die with it.
Are you able to change your name? Is there a legal recourse of like escaping the caste?
So
are there
only
cases
now,
of that?
So they don't change. You can't change caste at all. Many people have converted to other religions because the hierarchy in Hindu religion for people belonging to the lower caste is just so abhorrent and oppressive. That people decide that, you know, maybe if they choose some other religion, it would be slightly better because other religions, you know, as I said, want more people. So they welcome them. So it's like one more of theirs, right? So they welcome them and then they become that particular religion. But they lose out on a lot because only recently India has given a lot of affirmative actions to people belonging to the bottom of the pyramid. Once you change religion, you get none of that.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So the government or the society is structured to Hindus, even if you're on the lower class of the Hindu hierarchy, you're still given special privileges that the other religions don't have. Is that what you're saying?
That's not quite what I'm saying, but if you're born in a certain religion, it's fine. But if you convert to another religion because of your status of being the lower caste, you lose out. Yeah. There's all kinds of...
It's like they
force you to stay oppressed. Or they give you this illusion of benefits, but they're just an illusion. So you think that it's going to do something good to you and your children perhaps. But no, it's like you're willfully staying there, letting your master kick you around.
Hmm.
And think of a woman in this position. All kinds of sexual implications to that. So yeah, my country is incredible, like I said.
I can understand why you want to nuke everybody, seeing that firsthand.
No, I'm saying all these things aside, human beings still deserve to be nuked. It's not just because I'm from India and that, you know, I see all these grave injustices happening to the world. And that's, I mean, my country, that's why I'm saying all these things. But yeah. I would like to
see the film that you make on that, like arguing the case, the end of man. I'd like to see.
Maybe you will not be able to watch it.
Maybe I won't. I won't. Maybe you'll just like, it'll be a reality TV show.
Well, please don't provoke me.
I don't want to. So we have Dysphoric out, and you have a couple other movies. Dysphoric is four parts. It explores the transgender situation from your perspective. It also does a lot of work unearthing or investigating the detrans side of that. And then in part four, you get into where we are now, where are we going, how does this affect us? Are you still promoting that? Is there something else in the future of that? Are you working on that right now still to get the word out? Is there something more that you would like to plug on top of that?
Well, I do want more people to watch it. I want more people in India to watch it because there's like this dreadful silence. I don't know if you've been seeing that. I've been tweeting saying how Indian media is not giving a damn about this film. Otherwise, they usually write a thing or two about my film in my city, at least. They more than one newspaper writes about the films that I make because it's like a safe thing. It's like an issue that concerns a lot of people. So it's a safe bet to write about it. Oh, there's this city-based filmmaker that has made a film on, say, sexual harassment in workplace. That's safe. But a city-based filmmaker who's challenging queer theory and is going after all these people, trans rights activists, is not safe at all. So they're not writing about it. Even after me emailing them, they're not writing about it. There is a dreadful silence.
Why are the trans rights activists so powerful in India?
Well, they're just powerful everywhere, aren't they?
Okay. Just seems rather queer that they're being kowtowed to.
I see what you did there.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
I dropped that in there.
Yes, it is. And these people are also the people that are your editors, media houses. It's very difficult to not sound like a conspiracy theorist right now, but all these media houses are also held by, owned by billionaires who also have like private hospitals, mental health facilities. So basically, they want to glorify transgenderism using their media so that people can take it and run with it. And go to their private hospital, spend lakhs and lakhs of money, get sex reassignment surgery. So, I mean, right now I sound like a conspiracy theorist. I know, I agree, I concede.
It does. It's really difficult to convince people if you follow the money. It's like, it's pretty dreadful. Like, as an industry, I don't know how many millions or billions of dollars they make off of people, but they make thousands, hundreds of thousands off of an individual that transitions sex, like over the course of their lifetime.
A lot of corporate funding, you know, the social responsibility thing, the CSR funding that they set aside every year that they need to give it to a good cause, corporate social responsibility. That's the CSR funding. They're supposed to give it to a good cause. Every single organization that I know has given it away for queer or pride or rainbow or things like that.
And why aren't they giving it to women first?
We've been asking for centuries now.
No.
We've been asking, man. I swear, we've been trying.
Shoot. Well, is there a path towards, if this transgender thing takes off in India, can't women just elect out of womanhood? Or do you think that their position will still be held?
That's what's happening now, right? Even though they've decriminalized homosexuality, you still can't marry within the same sex. So in India, even though a lot of people are opting out of marriage and the whole institution of marriage, a lot of our rights are associated with the whole institution of marriage itself. Because it's only when you marry somebody, there is insurance, there is property rights, there is all kinds of other, you know, the way you can
get resources.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So if anything, people should fight for gay marriage. They're not doing that. They're fighting for championing men who identify as trans as sex workers. So in the pride, in our citywide pride, there is this red umbrella thing, which means sex workers. I was shocked. I've stopped going to Pride entirely, but I was shocked how many people, really educated people belonging to good positions in, you know, city offices and everything, holding red umbrellas in support of prostitutes, sex workers. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. That happens. And every city has a Pride March, obviously. Yeah. everybody has a red umbrella.
That is, I'm just so out of my depth here. I just can't, I mean, I don't have an official position on sex work one way or the other, and I'll keep it that way so that I can continue to do journalism from a, you know, relatively, you know, nuanced or you know, nuanced position. But like centering sex work as like the celebration, we're celebrating that. It just, this seems like something not right there. I can't put my finger on it. I mean, no, I have moral qualms of that, but there's something else going on.
Their position about wanting to give the woman her choice to do sex work comes from a point of empathy. They maintain that these women are, you know, belonging to a marginalized community. They do not have enough to go by. But shouldn't you be addressing that rather than saying that it's okay if she's getting raped by 10, 20 men every night?
If she's getting a couple of rupees out of it, though, right? I'm totally being very, very snide there.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot of comments about it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm just saying, like, that joke is there to highlight the horror of that.
Well, that's what they say, you mean, right? But yeah. But we all know all the other, even the people that are actually doing sex work have been documented during COVID. They've been documented, you know, slightly anonymously. Some of them don't even care. They're there out front, just in public, talking about it. They're saying that there's this analogy that they use, saying, oh, you know, Indian men rape so much, but we exist because they can then take their sexual frustration out on us. Therefore, you women can be safe.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So they are the saviors.
They're the saviors. They're the victims, however you want to call it.
Oh, weird.
So weird.
Wow. Yeah. There's just layers of it. And you know, a lot of it's actually marketing.
Yeah.
It's just so out of this world.
Yeah. And who is the person who's saying that? Who is the person who's normalizing all this? Trans-identified male.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They are the ones that are out there doing it for a very, very long time. They've been historically known to be doing prostitution, right? Yeah. But are they speaking for the girls that got trafficked into this trade? I don't think so. Who gives them the right? Who gives them the right to be the voice of all the women that are, you know, whether by choice or not, are doing this trade? And yet the trafficked girl is never going to be hurt. Who's the face of this whole gender thing? A man.
Yeah. Like, I guess one thing about that red umbrella thing is that if everybody's, like, you know, fronting this red umbrella during Pride, and what that means is that they're trying to clean up the sex industry. They're trying to make sure that trafficking doesn't happen, that voluntary act, it's all voluntary. If that's what it was about, then I could see how it is a point of pride that they're working towards that. But it doesn't seem like that is even a concern.
Even if they're trying to clean up the sex industry, how can you guarantee that a girl is trafficked or not? How can you guarantee that a little girl who's probably not even, who's probably still a minor, 13, 14 year old, who's been drugged and has been made into an addict, and she has to sleep with somebody for her to get that dose for the day? How can you guarantee to clean this industry for her?
Yeah.
Are you going to tell me that you marching with red umbrella is somehow going to change the mind of this one asshole who's pimping this little girl, probably from his own family? I don't think so. I'm sorry, I entirely disagree that if you do it by choice, somehow it becomes okay. Choice is extremely, extremely dubious word in a country like ours. We can buy it. We men have bought it. They give you that illusion, and you disillusioned that you believe that you have this choice, but you're not. You're merely being held by, you know, threads by this puppeteer. You're not doing anything by yourself. You're not able to move about freely. You know, decide where you want to go at, like, in the middle of the night. You can't do any of that. If you remove patriarchy entirely from an Indian society, I would like to think of a time like that and the choices that women make at that time, you know, and if they choose, if they want to make money by having sex with men, then that's a different story.
Yeah. Yeah.
You haven't
taken it goes back to. It goes back to these Western ideals, which kind of work and seem progressive when they are resting on top of a lot of other law and work and culture and certain mores in our culture, then you can start playing around with gender and stuff like that. You take all that work aside, and then you import these progressive ideals into India, and it either stalls progress or it sets it back, because it's obscuring the issues that you see. It's obscuring the rights of women. I really do like that that thought experiment of like of say, okay, well, what is this country without this specific misogynistic behavior accepted and promulgated by men? Then as that is the floor, then we can start doing these experiments. But until you get to that, all this liberalism as construed in terms of feminism is not even
even useful, this whole helpful. Choice of wanting to be boys, right? If you take away misogyny and patriarchy, would women still want to be men? I doubt it. Well, if they still do, then that's okay. But at least we won't have patriarchy. Then that's a free world for women. It is how a woman would feel, like how a man would feel every morning when he wakes up. Absolutely carefree. A man wakes up and he doesn't have to think 10 things in the next half hour what he has to do. But a woman should. And if she's a working woman, she has to decide. Like I do it every day. If I have to go out on the field to do some film work, I have to decide based on what locality I'm going to. And that decides exactly what I wear from top to bottom. I wake up and I already am calculating how the rest of my day is going to be. I don't think you've ever done that other than, you know, organizing work per se.
I live in the woods. I don't interact with people. So that takes a lot of load off.
Good for you.
Just speaking personally. What do you think is going to be the next topic? Or are you done with the transgender topic? Is there more for you to explore?
No.
Where are you headed with that then? Or what's next? Where are you going as an artist, as a worker in your work?
Well, as an artist, there are 100 other things that I want to explore and want to make films about. But in the transgender issue itself, my activism is going to carry on. Perhaps not in the way of film, because the film is pretty elaborate and exhaustive, I think. And that's that. Perhaps if there are any significant changes within Indian media and there are people in India that are willing to talk about, maybe I will come up with snippets for it. But my goal right now is to use this film and use my advocacy to actually bring about ground level changes, speak to politicians, at least, you know, lay this ground for having the bare minimum distinction between the word gender and sex and not conflict.
Okay.
That is what I hope to do. It's ambitious, extremely ambitious. Nobody gives a damn about me. No politician is going to sit down and have a chat with me, but I'm going to try. What else can you do?
I don't know. Get Brad Pitt on board and you might be able to make some waves, you know.
Will he identify as a woman?
No, you just, I don't know. He identifies as a, you know, wildly handsome savior of mankind. Like that's basically all you need.
Yeah, like how Leonardo DiCaprio is for environment.
Maybe that's what you need. You need a very hot, dirty dishwater blonde Hollywood actor on your side that'll turn some heads. I'm spitballing here on how to help you out. not that I know anybody like that. I might be able to wrestle somebody up. So you're gonna that sounds like a very particular. It even sounds. I mean, I guess like our entire 2-hour conversation, hour and a half conversation is just around the fact that making a distinction between gender and sex would be a huge win in India. And it's a huge hill to walk up, just that small little thing. But at least you have something concrete to aim for and that people can get their minds around, because one, the people who even know about the situation that's happening in the Americas, in the West on this, which is not nearly as many people as it should be, even they who have a key or a clue in what's going on here on this topic have no idea what it's like from your perspective. And I guess I'm sure that there's other people in your position or other cultures similar to yours that has a similar effect, this gender. Ology is having a similar effect.
Yes. And like you said, you know, winning this whole distinction between sex and gender is like barely a win, you know, because if you get that, actually work begins then.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like how I made this film now. It's like 1 year of me, you know, digging myself a hole and sitting inside the house and just editing. And I come outside and now my work has actually begun to actually make it reach people, make people watch it, make politicians watch it, understand the situation, how grave it is. It's just really, really scary because you know in your head things are about to go very bad very soon. But right now, in this moment, it's too soon for anybody else to see it. And it kills me that they're not able to see it because I know things are going to get bad. And you'll just sound like an idiot right now because you're not inclusive, you're not intersectional, you're not woke, and you're just a very hateful person who's probably, oh, I've been told that I need to get laid. Otherwise, that's why I'm being all cranky. And apparently for you to be a feminist, you got to be ugly. So they make radical feminists as like the female incels or something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You don't fit that bill, but
I'm definitely not an incel. I'm not interested in trying to go after a man at all, ever. I'm not homosexual, but I am so in support of my lesbian sisters wanting a separatist movement. I am for it. Even if I lose all the men that I love in the process, it's worth it.
Wow. You're like the, what's her name, from Alien? Oh, what's her name? Why am I like Sigourney Weaver? You're a warrior.
No.
You're a warrior. Yeah, you are. You're a fighter. You're a champ.
Is this the time of the podcast when you make your guests awkward or something?
Yeah, we started awkward. We're going to end awkward.
I didn't start awkward.
When I asked you to introduce yourself, you got all blushy.
Don't you think it's the most... No. I did not get blushy. I got cranky. Don't you think it's the most boring thing to say, oh, what it is that you do?
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't like when I'm interviewed and then somebody does that on camera. Like, can you just do that after we talk? I don't want to listen to you do this. This is so boring. Let's just start talking.
Yeah, exactly. This also happens when you meet people outside randomly and they ask you, so what do you do? It's so hard to explain to them what I do. So if depending on who's asking, I say I'm a writer or say I'm a filmmaker or I say I'm just at home right now, not doing anything, not working. So there are like different answers that I use, but it is so boring. So you meet somebody and the first thing you want to know is whether they have a job or whatever.
Yeah. It's boring. Well, you have to start somewhere. It's either that or the weather.
Yeah, but why can't we just talk about, you know, immediately get down to business and talk about how to shake patriarchy off or, you know, things like that. And that's my kind of friendship.
What have you done to smash the patriarchy today?
I don't know. Spoken to you?
Did you? Are you using me as your hammer today?
Not to you, I'm using myself.
Taking a crack at it? Or, okay, so I'm the window, you're the hammer.
Something like that.
You just smashed me.
In the process, yes.
My mind was open. The tints have come off my glasses somewhat. I'm not ready to nuke the world, though.
It is a beautiful place. It's just unfortunate. I don't want to nuke the world. I want to nuke humans. That's a whole lot
humans,
of different.
Humans, yeah. I don't know. I think we're redeemable. I think we do a lot of awesome things. I think we do.
Not from where I stand.
Yeah. Well, you know, you'll make that movie. After you smash the patriarchy, you can smash the humanity.
Yeah. If there's one thing I'm against, that would be all the damage that men are doing in this world and all the very different, very creative ways in which we try and oppress some class at some point, all the time. I'm dead against it. And I think the one solution that I can possibly conceive is by getting rid of the oppressor and the oppressed too. There is nobody to oppress. It's just, you know, it's like how it used to be in the past. You know, it's animals. They'll figure the way out. They've got better laws than we do.
All instinct, just hunger. And then playing kittens. Is there more tours? Are you doing more? Do you have more interviews coming up? Are you going to be doing more interviews yourself for your work? Do you have a channel? Are you working on something like that? I'm listening. I need to shut a door.
Yeah, okay. I have this vlog that I talked to you about. I'm going to continue.
That sounds pretty fun, actually.
Oh, you haven't seen it? I've interviewed a lot of women there.
Yeah, just compile that. Compile that.
Yeah, so you're saying keep making it.
Yeah, keep doing that. That sounds like a great project. That's going to lead to something pretty cool down the road.
Yeah, that and writing and just films. I don't know. I don't really think about future much.
Yeah, me neither. I'm booked out for the next 2 weeks. Then that's Ramadan. I don't know what happens after that. So.
Yeah, you were booked out the last 2 weeks as well. You had interviews. Off the record, Benjamin. Can I call you Benjamin?
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.